Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, November 8, 2013, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference calls on the burden of proof in the world of patents, Medtronic versus Boston Scientific at the United States Supreme Court. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Gregory Dolan, co-director at the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, who is going to tell us all about the oral argument that took place earlier this week. A more complete bio for our speaker was provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Professor Dolan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christopher, so much. Thank you again for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be here. I'll talk a bit about the argument that happened on Tuesday. I will give one sort of caveat or fair warning. I was unfortunately unable to attend the argument live, but I've read the transcript several times, and so my views, I guess, it does not include observing the justice's facial expressions or sort of the courtroom reaction, so it's just based on a pure cold transcript. So before I get into the argument, I want to talk about how this case came about. Basically, it's a declaratory judgment action between Medtronic, that was the plaintiff, and Boston Scientific, that was the defendant. And Medtronic was seeking a declaration that it was not infringing Boston Scientific patents. Medtronic actually was a licensee of Boston Scientific. So Boston Scientific holds a number of patents on implantable fibrillators that are used to pace the heart for people who suffer from heart attacks or otherwise have irregular heartbeat. And they've licensed those patents to Medtronic, and I'll talk a little bit later about sort of the interesting nature of these licenses, which made it perhaps a bit harder for Boston Scientific to argue its side of the case. But in any event, Medtronic is a licensee and has continued to pay royalties pursuant to the license into an escrow account as it was manufacturing and selling its cardiac defibrillator devices. Interestingly enough, the license also prohibited Boston Scientific from bringing suit or countersuit against Medtronic for any infringement, provided Medtronic continued to pay royalties, which kind of makes sense. You know, if Medtronic is following its obligations, there's no suit to be brought. Medtronic, unfortunately, decided at some point that perhaps it's paying royalties for no reason. Perhaps the patent in question doesn't cover their devices, and so they brought a suit. And the question was ultimately who bears the burden of proof in this situation. And the reason that was even a question is because there's two competing rules or two clashing rules in this situation. The first rule is that, generally speaking, patentee always is the one who bears the burden of proof to prove infringement. After all, he wants to convince the court that somebody else is violating his patents, his property rights. The clashing rule is that the party seeking relief from the court is the one that always bears the burden to prove its case. And in this case, it's Medtronic that wanted relief from the court, wanted a declaration that it is not infringing somebody's patents. Boston Scientific was not going to court on this one. So why did this even come up? Because prior to 2007, this case could not have existed. Well, prior to 2007, a licensee, the rule was that a licensee could not sue for declaratory judgment of non-infringement unless he stopped paying royalties, on a theory that as long as royalties are being paid, there's no fear of a lawsuit and therefore no case of controversy. And conversely, if a royalty payment stopped, the licensee became an infringer and infringement counterclaim on the part of a patent holder became compulsory. So prior to 2007, it didn't matter who had the burden of proof in a underlying DJ action, since in order to retain any leverage, the patentee had to either prove infringement in his counterclaim that was compulsory or else waive that argument forever. So at the end of the day, patentee always bore the burden of proof. But in 2007, in a case called MedImmune, Supreme Court said that a licensee can bring a DJ action while continuing to pay royalties so as to minimize the risk to itself. And this is exactly what happened here. Medtronic continued to pay royalties, but wanted relief from doing so in the future, and so they brought a DJ action. So I said, so Boston Scientific argued that since they're the ones seeking relief from the court, they should be the one proving that they, in fact, are not infringing. And a federal circuit agreed with that position, and ultimately cert was granted. I said I wanted to briefly talk about the license because the license was a bit odd in this situation, and I think that's where ultimately Boston Scientific Council ran into certain definitional problems. So the license, traditionally a license is, the simple license is when a patentee says, I have a patent, you have a widget X. It seems to me that widget X infringes on my patent, but I'm willing to license the patent to you for that widget X if you pay me certain amount of money, whether in percentage terms or flat fee or whatever else. In this case, though, what happened was that Boston Scientific realized that Medtronic is going to continue to improve its implantable fibrillators, and every so often will come up on the market with new and improved devices. And so this license said not only does Medtronic have to pay for the current products on the market, they have to, whenever they come up with a new product, they have to give Boston Scientific advance notice so that Boston Scientific can evaluate the new product and then send the letter saying whether or not that new product is still covered by the old patents. And if so, then Medtronic would be obligated to pay more into, so the more coverage, the more royalties they will be paying. And so that's what Medtronic was obliged to do. And that's what ultimately they wanted to stop doing. So in a sense, this license essentially required Boston Scientific every so often, whatever new product that came on the market, to essentially write a letter alleging that absent royalty payments, there would be an infringer, right? Because they would write a letter saying, this new product is covered by our patents. So that's the background to the case. Now sort of on to the argument. Medtronic went first. They were the petitioner. And their basic argument was that it was not even essentially a patent law argument. It was a pure kind of civil procedure argument. And their position was that a declaratory judgment action, whether in a patent case or also in any other field of law, does not shift the burden of proof onto the person seeking the declaration. That declaratory judgment action is procedural rather than substantive device. So, for example, if you are seeking declaratory judgment action alleging that, for example, some sort of government action is unconstitutional, you would bear the declaration. You will bear the burden of whether you're doing it in a DJ action or whether you're challenging the government's law or regulation after a case having been brought against you. So, who's on the first side of the V and who's on the second side of the V really doesn't matter. It's purely a procedural question. And so, Medtronic said the same thing should apply in a patent case, whether you are a defendant and using non-infringement as a defense, or whether you are the plaintiff seeking a declaration from the court, really shouldn't matter. And the fact that patentee is no longer required to bring a counterclaim of infringement, as it was before MedImmune, doesn't free from responsibility to prove why his patents cover a particular device that Medtronic is trying to market. Now, one question was that came out from Justice Kennedy. He said, well, what about fairness? Here we have Boston Scientific. They are kind of, they're just sitting there. They license to you their patents precisely with the notion that they don't want to be brought to court. They are sort of, they're sitting not expecting this lawsuit. And there you are, you come in kind of unexpectedly, you sue them. And on top of that, you actually require them to bear any sort of burden of proof. That just doesn't seem fair. It would have been much more fair if you make Boston Scientific sue, in which case, you know, they thought about their legal position, they thought about how they want to do, they thought about which court they want to file in. But in this situation, Justice Kennedy asked, well, what about this sort of fairness rule? To which Seth Waxman, who was arguing the case for Medtronic, he said, well, it's not unfair because, after all, number one, Boston Scientific knew that it could be sued, especially after MedImmune. That a licensee could bring suit. And number two, Boston Scientific got a lot of benefits out of this license. For example, they got initial preview of the future, future products that Medtronic was bringing to market. It got a chance to evaluate those products before they hit the market, and it got a chance to demand payments on those products as opposed to investigating something that's already on the market and trying to figure out whether or not to bring suit. Interesting enough, Seth Waxman was not questioned too much on his position. He went on for quite some time based on a transcript with very few sort of questions being lobbed at him. One question that was somewhat hard for him came from Justice Kagan, who asked, well, what about the situation where you have a sort of a more traditional license, where you have the one license that I described before? On this widget X, you take this license on that device only, and then immediately turn around and sue. So as essentially, again, getting into this fairness issue, that this way, as soon as you take the license and you sue, you get a chance to select what court you're in and so on. And so that may be somewhat unfair. And Medtronic answered that those situations can be prevented by the nature of the agreement themselves. So, for example, he posited a situation that an agreement could include a proviso saying that if the licensee sues the patent holder, the royalty will go up to 2x. Or if the licensee sues the patent holder and, for example, and loses, that he bears not only the cost of litigation but actually the lawyer's fees as well. So he said to the extent that there's maybe this situation of this sort of double dealing, that can be dealt with by contractual language itself. United States government appearing as amicus argued next, and again was mostly uninterrupted. They supported Medtronic's position. They again said that it's not unfair to the patentee to have this rule, that they would, even if they are the ones hailed into court, they're still the ones having the burden of proof, because in some ways, according to the government, that there is no clash of these two initial rules, that the party seeking, you know, on one hand, patentee having the burden of proof, and on the other hand, the party seeking relief having the burden of proof. They said, in some ways, there is no clash here because although Medtronic is continuing to pay royalties, they're paying them into escrow account. Boston Scientific doesn't actually have access to this money just yet. So in some ways, the government said, both parties are actually trying to change the status quo. Medtronic wants to say that we don't want to pay money anymore, and Boston Scientific wants to say we want access to the escrow account. And if that's true, then there's no reason why Boston Scientific shouldn't have the burden of showing why they should be having access to this escrow account, i.e. why the money should be transferred from this neutral account to their bank account. Finally, Boston Scientific's attorney got up to speak, and he tried to make a distinction between an assertion of infringement on the part of a patentee, which would cause him to bear the burden of proof, versus what happened here. And as the way I read the transcript, and I read it a couple of times, I just don't understand his argument, and I don't think the justices did either. What Boston Scientific argued is that in this case, these letters exchanges between Medtronic and Boston Scientific, when Medtronic would send them a letter saying, we are coming up with a new product, it's going to have these features, and Boston Scientific would evaluate and say, well, it's covered by this patent of ours, and so you owe us royalty payments. They said these are not letters alleging infringement. These are letters alleging, quote, coverage, patent coverage. And I don't quite understand that argument. It seems to me that if a device is covered by a patent, it's the same thing of saying that a device infringes a patent. That's what coverage by a patent actually means. So and I think the Boston Scientific attorney ran into trouble with that argument because it is really hard to understand. Perhaps there was a better way of explaining it, but this sort of this coverage versus infringement distinction didn't make a whole lot of sense, and I don't think impressed a lot of justices. The second problem that the Boston Scientific ran into was this question of what Justice Scalia posed as to what would happen if the court were to adopt his rule. So, well, suppose we adopt your rule and the burden is going to be on Medtronic. They come to court, they ask for the court's declaration of non-infringement. The court says, well, you didn't carry your burden of proof, so we're not saying that you're not infringing. What happens next? Can Boston Scientific then sue, for example, Can they sue Medtronic? To which the Boston Scientific attorney said, well, if they stop paying royalties, of course we can sue them. And so Jessica Lee said, well, but does that mean that we have to start the process all over again? Expert witnesses again, expert reports, trial testimony. So that seems to be extraordinarily inefficient. And although the Boston Scientific attorney initially said, well, you don't have to start all over again, you can sort of take the testimony from the old trial into a new trial and figure out who, you know, where the burden of proof falls now, it was about argument. That didn't seem to convince anyone. It seemed that, you know, if the burden of proofs are different, you may want to put on slightly different cases. And so this notion of duplicative judicial work, I think, resonated with a number of justices. And I don't think Boston Scientific had a necessarily good answer to that. So, and I think the argument went quite poorly for the Boston Scientific attorney to the point that when Seth Waxman got up for his rebuttal, he actually chose not to give one. He said that if the court, unless the court had any other questions, that he's willing to rest on briefs. And generally that's a sign of an attorney who's pretty confident that, you know, that the only thing that he can say in rebuttal is most likely to hurt him rather than to help him. So that's, I think, how the argument went. Again, I think that it's pretty clear that the justices were more impressed with Medtronic's legal position than with Boston Scientific's, although it's always hard to prognosticate and dangerous to prognosticate how the courts will rule. But given sort of the tenor of the questions and the inability of the Boston Scientific's attorney to explain this difference between coverage and infringement, I would expect that a reversal is in the offing. And I think I'll stop here and open the floor for more questions.
Fantastic. Well, if you would like to ask Professor Dolan a question, the floor mode will be on once you'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. So again, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we've got our first question on the line.
Hi, Lenora Stosky here. If the Supreme Court reverses this case, what would then be the duty of Medtronic with regard to what they set out to do? Describe their actions, what they should be doing if this case is reversed.
I would imagine that Medtronic, if the case is reversed, I think Medtronic sort of wins because Medtronic actually did have a trial before this went all the way up to the, you know, Federal Circuit and Supreme Court. And the trial judge simply said that trial judge actually agreed with Medtronic that it's Boston Scientific that has the burden of proof. And they said they didn't carry their burden of proof of shown infringement and therefore awarded Medtronic a declaration of non-infringement. So if the Federal Circuit reversed saying the trial judge screwed up on the burden of proof and therefore the trial needs to start anew. Now, there was also a question of claim construction as to whether the trial judge can properly construe the claims. So to the extent that the claims are properly construed, then the case is pretty much at an end. Medtronic doesn't need to do anything. Trial judge would have gotten it right. To the extent that the claims were improperly construed and there needs to be a new trial with more properly construed claims, then essentially it's going to be just like a traditional patent trial with expert witnesses and Boston Scientific trying to prove infringement. The only thing that would change is that Medtronic would be on the left side of the V and Boston Scientific would be on the right side of the V. But in every other respect, it would be just like a traditional patent trial or just like any DJ action that happened before MedImmune when the patentee had a requirement to bring a infringement counterclaim.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
If you were the general counsel of Medtronic, the letter you would draft to someone, to a company like Boston Scientific, would say something like, we believe that the changes we have made or the additions we've made to this device are not covered by your patent, therefore it would not infringe, and therefore we do not plan to pay royalties based on, or license fees based on, our construction of this patent. End of letter. Is that what they would write?
Except I think for the second part, because I think the whole point is that Medtronic wants to continue paying royalties absent judicial declaration that they don't have to, because they don't want to be on the hook, for example, for willful infringement, because they know of the patent, right? So I don't think there will be this second clause saying we're not going to pay royalties. There may be very well a letter being saying, we don't think we infringe, we don't think we want to pay royalties, and let's talk about it, and if not, we're going to bring sort of a DJ action.
I see. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Chris Ciccone in Boston. I was just kind of curious for your own observation of the justices, did you see them sort of looking at the court below favoring the patent holders? It said that it looks like they might have had concerns that the Federal Circuit put their thumb on the scale for the patent holders. And also related to that is, if they kick over the court below, do you think that this will have an adverse effect on the cost of patenting or granting patents in the future? Thanks.
So let me actually start from the second question first. I'm not quite sure it's going to have a cost of granting patents as such. It very well may have a cost on licenses. So in other words, if the patentee now will know that not only can they be hailed to court at any particular place, pretty much at a drop of a hat, and yet they'll still bear the burden of proof, the license fees might go up, or the license terms might be more harsh along the lines that Mr. Waxman suggested, saying, for example, if you sue us, you're going to be liable for not just your own attorney fees, but for our attorney fees as well. Or, you know, the royalty rate will go up to, you know, twice what it was before should you lose, or things like that. So it may be more expensive to negotiate, and therefore, you know, therefore the license may be less likely to be negotiated to begin with. So that may be sort of the effect. Although I'm not sure how large that effect would be, because after all, that was kind of the rule beforehand, before MedImmune. If you were sued, you had to bring your compulsory counterclaim. Then again, you couldn't be sued unless your licensee stopped paying and exposed himself to a large potential sort of treble damages award. So I don't think so. The short answer is no. I don't think it's going to affect granting of the patents. It might very well affect the licensing of the patents. Now, on the first question, did the court seem concerned about Federal Circuit putting their thumb on a scale? Again, like I said, I wasn't actually at the oral argument, so it's just based on the transcript. I don't think that necessarily was the major concern. I think it was just a concern of, did the Federal Circuit get the civil procedure right? I'm not quite sure this was necessarily somehow exclusive to patents. And to be fair, that's not the first time when the Federal Circuit, in the view of the Supreme Court, simply created a unique patent-based rule. And Federal Circuit has been chastised by the Supreme Court for a number of times when the Supreme Court perceived that the Federal Circuit is abandoning rules that are applicable to all other cases and creating this patent-specific jurisprudence. And so if that's how they view the case, that Federal Circuit tried to create this sort of unique patent-only rule for declaratory judgment actions, then, like I said, I think they will reverse, and it will probably reverse unanimously, given that they have been explicit on a number of occasions saying, Federal Circuit, you shouldn't create patent-only rules. Patent litigation is just that. It's just litigation. It's not that special.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. We've got one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the pound key, and we'll move on to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I do see another approach to this subject that I'd like to have you explore, and that would be to treat the matter as a writ, prerogative writ.
I'm sorry, treat the matter as well, I didn't catch that.
As a prerogative writ.
A prerogative writ, okay.
As you are aware, a prerogative writ is not a petition, but a demand. And the demand is for proof on the part of the respondent. So, for example, in a habeas corpus, the demandant doesn't have to prove that the custodian is improperly holding a prisoner. He's demanding that the custodian prove his authority to hold the prisoner. So if we imagine that a patent is a kind of office, then privilege granted by, the public, then the burden of proof would fall on the alleged office holder that he has the authority to hold that office, namely to exercise the patent rights.
That's a very interesting proposal. I haven't sort of thought about it that way. I think that's a pretty good analogy, saying that if the declaratory judgment action for non-infringement essentially requires the patentee to show why he should continue to demand royalties from a company like Medtronic. The only sort of wrinkle to that approach is that the license could be interpreted as an agreement ex ante, right? That they do in fact have authority, right? It's not as if Boston Scientific necessarily threatened them with suit, and as a result of the threat, Medtronic came to court. Medtronic agreed to pay those fees, so they've agreed that the patent is in fact valid, and by paying royalties, they're arguably. Agree that the patent would be infringed but for the payment of those royalties. Obviously, they take a slightly different view because they're saying, look, we're not paying them directly, we're paying them into an escrow account precisely because we are not sure that our devices infringe the product. So the fact that that license exists does create a bit of a wrinkle into this sort of prerogative writ analogy. But it's interesting, and I would have to think about it some more.
Well, our lines are currently open, so if you would like to ask a question of Professor Dolan, this is your opportunity to. So again, press star and then the pound key, star and then the pound key. And just a quick programming note that next week, beginning on Thursday, is our annual National Lawyers Convention. And also, please don't forget to check out www.executivebranchproject.com, part of the Federal Society's Practice Group's Executive Branch Review Project. Again, the blog is www.executivebranchproject.com. Well, Professor Dolan, it looks like we don't have any more questions on the line. I'll just give you, if you'd like, an opportunity to make a final statement or summarize things before we end the call.
Sure, and I think I'll just summarize where I began. I think ultimately this is not going to be a great revolution in patent law. I think given sort of the tenor of the questions and given where U.S. government ended up as amicus, I think it's just going to be reaffirmation of a traditional civil procedure question that declaratory judgment action, whether the issue involves patent law or anything else, simply does not shift the burden of proof in any civil case, both for reasons of the, both because it is a merely procedural device as opposed to a substantive vehicle for relief, and because of Justice Scalia's concern that doing anything different would create a huge waste of judicial resources. So, but we'll see. We'll see how the court comes out by end of June.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Greg Dolan for being on the call today. Thank you to our audience. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. We hope to see many of you next week at our National Lawyers Convention here in Washington, D.C., and on future Teleform conference calls. So until then, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, and see you there.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.